Om Prakash's advice sent Anya north to Baglung, chief town of Baglung District in the Dalagiri zone. A garishly painted bus took her from Lumbini almost into the center of the long strip-like country. It also took her up along precipitous narrow switchbacks. Baglung sprawled along a wide ledge at the base of a big hill. Its blocky, white, multi-storied structures, roofs pitched high to shed the massive yearly snowfall, spilled out onto a couple of naturally terraced sandstone buttes thrusting out over the river valley below. The land around was scrub and stands of small trees, pitching quickly up into more hills, dusted with snow, with the stark blue and white mass of the real mountains looming beyond. To the north, the gigantic white mountain, Dalagiri, shaped vaguely like a tooth, dominated the skyline. Anya's legs were a bit unsteady with remnant adrenaline. Some of those last hairpin turns had been hair-raising. Shouldering her pack, she hiked to the police headquarters to check in. It wasn't hard to find. An old British colony, heavily influenced by India and increasingly by the U.S., Nepal depended almost entirely on tourism to keep its economy rolling. So even in this remote place, English language signs abounded alongside the sinuous Nepali script. The cop shop was a three-story building with a roof of dove gray slate. The Baglung contingent of the armed police force were little men in brown berets, light gray shirts, darker gray trousers with white and orange stripes down the legs, black belts and boots. Their holsters held modern Glock auto pistols, Model 19s with high-capacity 9mm magazines. To Anya's surprise, each Glock was counterbalanced by what looked like a forward-curved short sword on the other hip. These had to be the Nepalese Kukris, made famous by their Gurkha mercenary troops. They still carried them in modern-day assignments in Afghanistan and elsewhere. Anya hadn't expected to see police officers toting huge fighting knives, though. Anya had filled out the usual reams of paperwork. She was all above board, prepared to brandish her documents from the JBF, as well as the letter of recommendation the well-respected Lama Om Prakash had provided her in Lumbini. But the police didn't care. Without so much as glancing at her archaeological bona fides, the officer had referred her to the Baglung District Commissioner for Antiquities, a man named Chatura. Somewhat to her surprise, the District Antiquities office lay outside of town proper, on a rocky little rise surrounded by dwarfish, wind-gnarled evergreens. Hiking up to it, lugging her bulky backpack, Anya found what should have been an easy walk quite hard. She knew it was the altitude that made it difficult. Baglung was something upward of 6,500 feet above sea level. Still, it wasn't anything serious. But Sirius was coming. She glanced at the white-clad mountain, which, though distant, loomed over the town. The stout, almost fortified appearance of the antiquities office startled her. It was a one-story stone blockhouse with narrow slit windows set high off the ground. Its position gave it a commanding view in three directions. The hill behind was steep enough to make it tricky for attackers to negotiate, and mostly bare of cover. She realized it had probably been a colonial police outpost at one time. The whitewash on the stones looked fairly recent to her archaeologist's eye. That made the gray dimples of bullet impacts in it even more recent. She stood outside the scarred red wooden door.
Well, they warned me civil disorder was on the rise here.
She entered a small room with a couple of chairs and a big metal desk. She shrugged off her big pack and let it down to the bare concrete floor. Though large, the desk wasn't the dominating design element in the room. That honor belonged to the gigantic portraits hung on the rear wall, flanking and indeed somewhat dwarfing a map of Baglung District. One of the portraits sported the unmistakable huge head and wide, grim face of Mao Zedong. The man in the other picture, this one a photo, was leaner and wore spectacles, but was equally humorless.
This is Prachanda, he whose clarity of vision lights the way forward to a progressive future for all nations, not just Nepal.
I'm pretty apolitical myself.
Not to be political is to be political. I am Chatura, District Commissioner of the Antiquities Division of the Ministry of Culture, Tourism, and Civil Aviation for Baglung. And you must be the American archaeologist I was informed had arrived.
Yes. My name is Anya. Anya Creed.
Anya proffered the thick bundle of papers she'd accrued since entering the country. Chatura accepted them with a sour expression.
You will investigate shrines then?
And catalog them for proper preservation, yes.
Once again, as much of the truth as possible seemed her best path.
So you will celebrate and spread the backward superstitions which have held humanity back for so long. Chairman Mao had the correct idea with his great proletarian cultural revolution, purging such baggage and breaking the chains of the past.
But these shrines are priceless relics, the common heritage of all mankind.
A common burden on mankind. And you have come bringing your Western decadence and your corrupting American dollars, which do not buy so much corruption as they once did, do they?
Anya shrugged. Her shoulders were knotting with tension. She had a hard time reining in her anger, but she knew it was vital she do so. She wouldn't be helping her employers, Nepalese archaeology, or her bank account if she was deported before she could reach her goal. The district commissioner had a round belly and a round head with close-cropped hair. He looked more like a snowman than an intrepid former guerrilla fighter. She figured he must be some old party hack, shuffled off to this nowhere job in a blockhouse outside a hick district capital, where the people with real power wouldn't have him underfoot.
It is the policy of the central government that this ministry bow to the wishes of foreigners who seek to meddle in our country. In the name of a past filled with oppression and slavery, in the interests of the proletariat, our General Secretary sees fit that we obey such edicts. And so my hands are tied. I must permit your survey. You will, of course, tender me a full report of its results.
Of course.
Anya didn't trust this man any further than she could dropkick him.
But be aware, Ms. Creed, if you engage in any counter-revolutionary activity, the consequences will be swift, sure, and severe. I shall watch you very closely indeed.
It was late afternoon in the remote country northwest of Baglung, near the fringes of the Dorpatan Hunting Preserve, which clung to the base of the Daulagiri Himal sub-range of the Himalayas. A light overcast covered most of the sky.
Anya, look there.
Crouching down next to a jumble of head-sized granite rocks with tufts of tan grass sprouting from the cracks, trying to figure out whether the formation was natural or had been piled by human hands, indicating a possible hidden shrine, Anya straightened and turned. Her chief guide and outfitter, Prasad Ali Mugger, was pointing back down the rocky valley. A small knot of men were hiking up the sloping valley, perhaps 500 yards behind and below them. Anya grabbed her binoculars. She held them to her eyes and adjusted the focal length.
They carry rifles.
Prasad was short, like most of the Nepali Anya had encountered, wiry and bow-legged, with a face seamed by long exposure to the sun. He was on the long side of middle age, late 50s or 60s. His hair, cropped close to his head, was the color of cold, rolled steel. But the years hadn't much diminished his sight. His unaided vision confirmed what Anya's binoculars were telling her. She counted perhaps half a dozen men. At least three carried long arms. One of them, to Anya's surprise, was unmistakably a long black M16. She knew the American-made weapon was standard issue to the Nepali armed forces.
Should I feel reassured by an M16? I wouldn't think Maoist guerrillas would carry a Western-made weapon, would they?
Like everyone else, the guerrillas must make do as best they can.
Lal, Prasad's nephew and chief helper, straightened from chopping some brush away from a possible opening in the rock pile and wiped sweat from his brow with the back of his hand. He was a pleasant young man with a shock of heavy blue-black hair and a kind of sad downturn at the outside of his eyes. His frequent grin made up for it. Lal had a rifle himself, an old bolt-action British Enfield 303 propped against a rock. Anya's third local helper, a cousin of Prasad's named Bahadur, set his pick down and stood up to watch and wait.
Will they give us trouble?
Armed strangers can always bring trouble. We can only wait and see.
Still showing no outward sign of having noticed the team, the strangers vanished behind a shoulder of land to Anya's right. Prasad looked at Lal, and Lal nodded. He picked up his Enfield and scrambled up the rock-strewed slope above them. In a moment, he was out of sight like a prairie dog down its hole. Anya noticed the older man was watching her with a guarded smile. She guessed he wanted to know whether she wished to try eluding the armed party or not. He showed no trace of nervousness or any desire to flee. Without presuming to speak, Prasad was telling her that there was no point in trying to hide. She nodded. He was a local. He knew a lot more about potential situations than she did.
So, what can we do?
His smile widened slightly. Clearly, it pleased him. His employer was proving reasonable. But his eyes continued to scan their back trail where the mysterious men had disappeared.
As I have said, we wait. See, be prepared for what the next turn of the wheel brings.
Meaning, if we've seen them, they've seen us, right?
Truly, you are wise beyond your years, Anya Creed.
Anya sat on a big rock near the base of the outcrop of gray stone she'd been working. She might as well conserve breath and energy for whatever came next. Though they weren't at a high elevation by Nepali standards, maybe 8,000 feet, Anya still had to remember to take frequent breaks. Prasad and Bahadur stood on a relatively level patch of ground a few feet below her. They lit cigarettes and waited. As she often did, Anya grew aware of the presence of the mighty main peak, Dalagiri 1. Even with her back to it, Anya could feel it like a living presence.
Heda!
Six men appeared and began to scramble down the scrubby slope toward them. As the party approached, Anya stood and smiled.
Hi, can we help you?
The newcomers swaggered up. They acted careless, in the sense that they apparently saw nothing here to care about. Her team showed no visible firearms, though Prasad and Bahadur wore big knives. While the knives were clearly related to the kukri, the men used them so casually in the most brutally utilitarian contexts, as machetes, axes, or even pry bars, that Anya presumed they were tools rather than weapons. Although, that didn't mean they couldn't do damage. One man stepped forward, a black leather belt, faded and cracked but looking like some kind of official issue, circled his rather capacious waist. A burly revolver rode in a holster on his right hip. Though the closed flap concealed most of it, Anya made it for a double-action Webley, the signature sidearm of British colonialism.
My name is Agrabat.
Two men with long arms flanked him. To his left was a big man who looked like an overstuffed hassock, with the stuffing sticking out from random locations. He held a 12-gauge single-shot break-action shotgun with an extremely weathered stock. The forestock was attached to the long barrel with tarnished copper wire. Anya judged that if he fired it, it was even odds whether it would explode in his hands. That didn't make it any less dangerous to her and her friends. On Agrabat's right was a shorter, leaner man with an M16. Despite the uneven, threadbare black mat that grew on his jaws, he looked like a kid. The other three newcomers carried drawn, kukri-like knives, but no other weapons. Anya guessed Agrabat's sidearm, traditionally allowed only to officers, was his badge of authority.
We are with the Taurus Police. There has been word that you might be conducting unlicensed explorations. What is your business here?
On her way to Nepal, she had done a little of her customary internet research into the law enforcement structure of her destination. She knew a few things about the tourist police, who were associated with Commissioner Chatura's ministry.
Where is your hat?
We don't need hats. We are undercover.
But there's no tourist police detachment in Baglung.
She thought she saw Prasad's right eyebrow twitch up about a hundredth of an inch. She smiled at him. She already suspected this would not end well. These men were no more police than she was.
Bah! Enough delay! If you have the proper authorization, produce it at once.
Anya was prepared for the common trick of grabbing her papers and refusing to give them back. Before leaving Baglung, she had made Prasad hunt down a copy machine that wasn't in some official office. Finally, they used one in an official office, but it was after hours, and another cousin let them in the back. She had made multiple copies of all her documentation. It constituted their single heaviest item of luggage. Agrabat accepted her authorization from the armed police and the ministry. He studied them with a deepening scowl.
You don't try to hide it. You're hunting treasure.
Not the kind you're thinking of. We are cataloging shrines for eventual preservation by the Ministry of Culture, Tourism, and Civil Aviation.
You find treasure?
No.
In a week of tramping the uplands, her little team had turned up numerous small shrines in rock cairns, tumble-down wooden lean-tos, and caves. Aside from statues of the Buddha, mostly made of gold-painted plaster, they contained nothing that even the most optimistic thief could call treasure. And none of it was particularly old, either. All Anya had done was inspect the sites, photograph them on her digital camera, log them in her GPS, and move on.
You lie!
Neither the hassock with the shotgun nor the nervous kid with the M16 was pointing his weapon at anyone yet, but they were nervous. Anya sensed it was only a matter of time.
Wait.
She held up a hand and made a sort of smoothing down gesture. Even with Lal and his old Enfield as an ace in the hole, they were outnumbered and outgunned. Assuming Lal was even still in the vicinity, Anya didn't think he'd run off, but wouldn't blame him if he had.
We have little of value. We've found no treasure. We're not looking for any. We're merely looking for artifacts.
Agrabat's beard rounded in a smile around his gap-toothed mouth.
So, you'll find artifacts then?
Clearly, he knew about the relics trade, where even a piece of outright junk could command big money in the international market if it was old enough. Anya shook her head.
Nothing valuable yet, I told you. We're not collectors.
Agrabat looked toward his men.
Get ready, Anya.
You lie. We will see. We will take what we want in the name of the people. And maybe...
His smile widened, and his eyes ran down Anya's body like clammy hands.
Maybe we shall enjoy ourselves some, too.
Agrabat reached for his revolver. The gunmen to his left and right raised their weapons. His other men drew their knives with chilling deliberation. The kid with the M16 fell to the ground with a small hole in the center of his forehead. At the same moment, Bahadur's arm whipped up. A rock hit the hassock in the face. He dropped the shotgun and fell to his knees. Prasad jumped Agrabat and wrestled him for control of the still-holstered Webley. Bahadur lunged, knife in hand, at the man on the right. That left Anya facing the remaining two bandits. The nearer goon grinned and reached for her. Anya delivered a shin kick to the fork of his baggy trousers. She hoped she could get out of this situation without drawing the sword. That would raise too many inconvenient questions. But her opponent grabbed her left shoulder. Anya flattened his nose with her right elbow. His pal came lunging from the left with his knife cocked back over his shoulder. Anya's sidekick shattered a few of his ribs. Suddenly, strong arms enfolded her from behind. The hassock was back in the fight. The smell of him was so intense it was practically visible. Anya's legs flailed as he lifted her feet off the ground. He swung her around to face the man whose nose she had just smashed. He was grinning through a half-mask of his own blood, a kukri glittering in his hand. He drew his arm back to plunge the huge blade into her stomach. She whipped her head back. The hassock's grip relaxed. Anya whipped up both her arms to break the hug. Not wanting to play favorites, Anya smashed her elbow into his face as well. But the knife man was lunging for her. The one whose ribs she'd cracked was also on his feet and headed her way, knife in hand and eyes filled with rage. Anya formed her right hand into a half fist and reached with her will. Instantly, the sword was in her hand. The charging knife man's eyes flew wide. Next, she spun toward the bandit with the broken nose. As he grabbed his chest, dark blood flowed between his fingers. Anya turned to her right.
No!
Agrabah was falling backward with blood streaming from his head. Beside him, skinny Prasad, no longer bespectacled, followed through with his blade. Looming behind him, a kukri held blade down by two grubby, blood-stained hands, was the hassock, his face a bloody mask of rage and diabolical triumphant glee. He was too far for Anya to reach. As Prasad sensed the danger and began to turn, too late, Anya's eye lit on the wired-together shotgun lying unfired on the ground. Making the sword disappear, she swooped on the gun, picking it up one-handed like an oversized pistol. She winced in anticipation of the weapon's possible explosion in her face. Blood and cloth unraveled from the bandit's left forearm. He staggered back a step, but still kept a grip on the hilt of his knife. But he'd moved into Lal's line of fire. Anya shook her stinging right hand in the air, wishing she'd used her left. Prasad looked up the slope and waved to his nephew. Then he turned to his employer.
Are you injured, Anya Creed?
My hands felt better. With luck, it isn't broken.
Prasad bent down and picked up his glasses from where they had fallen. Miraculously, they remained intact. He put them on his nose and blinked through the round lenses at her.
You're bleeding!
Not as bad as Bahadur.
She pointed past Prasad with her chin to where his cousin squatted on the ground beside the body of his foe, who lay face down and unmoving. Bahadur's face was pinched and sallow. He clutched his left arm. The sleeve from biceps down was red and dripping.
Help him get fixed up. I'll see if I can handle this myself.
Anya had long since learned to be pretty adept with her left hand. She hoped her companions had been too preoccupied with their own battles to see the sword. Anya knew how life-and-death conflicts tended to produce tunnel vision. But Lal had been sniping, perched up above the action, probably 75 feet or less away. After checking to make sure that all the downed men were going to stay that way, Prasad knelt beside Bahadur. Anya found a large rock near her backpack and sat down. She was shaking as she dug in the side pocket for her first aid kit. Anya felt chilled, knew she was probably pale. Her fingers trembled and her joints felt like overboiled pasta. She recognized the after effects of the massive adrenaline dump triggered by fighting for her life, as inevitable as hitting the floor after rolling out of bed. Lal came down the slope. He held his stubby little Enfield at midpoint balance. He had evidently hung out up in his hideout perch to make sure the bandits hadn't had any pals following behind. He spared no more than a glance to the fallen men. But the young guide was giving Anya a curious eye. Her lips compressed. Her mind started sorting through the possible rationalizations, knowing they could only sound as unconvincing to this intelligent young man as they sounded to her. As rapidly and efficiently as a seasoned cook chopping vegetables, Prasad was slicing untainted parts of Bahadur's clothing into strips.
So those are real kukris. I thought they were just utility knives.
Just utility knives?
He wound a makeshift bandage. Anya hadn't gotten a close look at Bahadur's wound, nor was she eager to, but she was pretty sure his opponent had gotten a lick in on him that had laid the arm open to the bone.
It is all things, Anya Creed. It does whatever we call upon it to do. When we wish it to chop firewood, it is an axe. If we must drive nails, it is a hammer. When we fight, it is the finest weapon in the world.
Anya smiled and nodded, brushing away a wisp of hair that had strayed from the tight ponytail she normally wore in the field. Lal's head was tilted to the right, and he had a strange, appraising light in his eyes.
You handled yourself very well, Miss Creed.
For a tourist, you mean? I've had to learn to take care of myself since I was a kid. And I got lucky.
She didn't want to insult the intelligence of these men. They had, after all, put their lives on the line for her against terrible odds, never suspecting she might be capable of taking a useful hand in the fight, far less a decisive one. But a little of the self-effacing act couldn't hurt. She still hoped to defuse those questions she saw sparking behind Lal's eyes. And she knew she had been lucky, even though it didn't feel like it, as she bandaged her torn finger.
You fought well, too. Are all Nepali guides so handy in a fight?
When they are Gurkha.
You?
I served with the Indian Army and the Royal Singapore Police. My uncle fought with the British in Belize and the Falklands.
I thought you were Mugger.
We are. Gurkha come from many Nepali peoples.
My cousin did not serve abroad, but he, like my uncle and me, fought with the army against the communists. I watched the fight for a clean target. Something strange happened. I thought...
Straightening, Prasad stared sternly at the young man.
Lal, forget it.
Lal turned to her, pressed palms together, and bowed. It seemed to be in nature of a salute, though unusual, as it was normally used as an all-purpose hello or goodbye.
You fought as well as anyone I have seen, Miss Creed. I salute you.
Thanks. What about those men?
She waved at the bodies. Apparently all six were dead, which comforted her. She had a prickly certainty in her belly that if any had been merely wounded, her companions would have finished them off without compunction. That would put her in a place, legally and ethically, she didn't really want to go.
What do we do about the bodies?
Lal glanced at his uncle. Prasad helped Bahadur to his feet, then got him to sit on a rock to gather strength. Anya felt momentary concern about circulation being cut off in his wounded arm by the tight wrappings Prasad had applied. Then again, it was a long walk to any kind of real medical assistance, and if Bahadur bled out on the way, nothing else would matter much. Besides, it was clear the veteran Prasad had definitely done this before.
The ground here is hard, so we should start digging before the sun gets much lower. Fortunately, there are plenty of loose rocks to help us cover them.
Anya picked up a kukri that its former owner wasn't going to be needing again.
These are shovels too, I suppose?
Prasad and his nephew exchanged surprised looks.
When they must be. But you...
I'm an archaeologist, remember? I know how to dig. And the daylight won't last forever.
As was her habit, she came fully awake. It was a trick she'd had to learn. By reflex, she reached to her cell phone. Its lit face showed it was a little after 2 a.m. A lamp stood on the bedside table. She didn't turn it on. Power service had been spotty since the troubles restarted. Anyway, turning on a light inside would alert whoever was in the hallway. She was inside and awake. Cautiously, she slipped bare legs out from under heavy blankets, still smelling heavily of the original sheep, piled on her lumpy but cozy bed in the Boglung Inn she had made her main base of operations. Something slid beneath the door. Anya frowned at the envelope. The sword appeared in her hand. The stitches in her right forefinger and the bandages wound around it didn't hamper her grip as much as she'd feared. She crept noiselessly to the door. Anya listened closely for a moment. Then she slipped the chain as quietly as she could. And she peered out. The hallway was dimly lit by what seemed like a 5-watt bulb in a black iron sconce. It was enough light to show no one lurking there. Whoever had pushed the envelope under her door had slipped away just as mysteriously. Anya returned the sword to the otherwhere and reset the chain. Not that it would resist a stout kick, or, if the door was cracked open, a good shoulder. But she knew from living in the thieves' den that was New York that there was a certain benefit in culling the amateurs. It was like window screens and flies. If you didn't take the trouble to screen out all but the wiliest, you got nothing done but swatting. She turned on the table lamp and studied the mystery missive from several feet. It looked like a regular white envelope, the kind a hotel might leave in the drawer of the writing table, along with some stationery for the convenience of its guests. This inn offered no such amenities. She felt much put upon, and she needed sleep. In the morning, they were headed up to the heights, inside the Dorpatan hunting preserve. There would be much trudging and little oxygen to breathe. Trying to suppress dark thoughts of exotic contact poisons as way too pulp novel, she walked over, bent down, and picked up the envelope. It wasn't sealed. Inside was a scrap of blue-lined paper that had obviously been torn from a pocket notebook. On it was a couple of lines of Gorkhali script, handwritten in purple ink. Anya stared at it. Momentarily, she drew a blank. She wondered if she was being threatened by somebody not so bright, or if perhaps she was the victim of a wrong address. It struck her as entirely plausible that this might be a totally innocent message, intended for someone who actually read Gorkhali, that it had been pushed under the wrong door. Her initial sense of alarm had almost entirely faded. In its place was a wool blanket itch of curiosity. But she couldn't get somebody up to translate at this hour. For all she knew, it was a laundry list meant for the guy across the hall. Reluctantly, she set it on the bedside table. One useful trick she'd learned was how to blank her mind with the help of deep abdominal breathing exercises. If she didn't have that skill, she'd never get any sleep, considering the sort of life she led. In the morning, Anya drank coffee that, even well whitened with cream, grabbed her by the scruff and shook her awake. She ate big chunks of fresh, tough-crusted bread for breakfast.
Anya Creed?
She looked up. Prasad and Lal stood outlined in the doorway, blinking dubiously at the gloom.
Good morning, guys.
They advanced into the tourist-friendly cafe as if it were enemy territory. Clearly, they felt as out of place as they looked.
How's Bahadur? Please, take a seat.
He rests at his mother's house in the hills. He should recover soon.
The arm wound, which turned out to be more ugly than serious, had been stitched up at the same clinic that tended Anya's finger.
I'm glad.
You seem troubled.
Prasad smiled at her, but his eyes were more penetrating than she cared for behind his thick round glasses. It was still hard to think of this skinny, self-effacing man as a battle-hardened Gurkha veteran, even though she'd seen him leap into action like a tiger from the Dorpatan woods.
I was woken up last night by a letter being slipped beneath my door, but there was no one in the hall when I checked. It's written in Gorkhali. I can't read it.
Prasad and Lal looked at each other. She had the impression a whole extensive conversation took place in indecipherable and, to her, mostly undetectable body language right before her eyes.
May I see the letter?
She already had it out. She slid it across the white tablecloth to him. He flattened it carefully with both hands and bent to read it. She expected anger, outrage, perhaps even fear. Instead, a look of wonder spread across his rather delicate features.
Ah, you are invited to the Lamasery of the Woods. You have passed the first test.
A battered white land cruiser had hauled them wheezing up the flank of the Daulagiri Himal to Dorpatan village, north and west of Baglung. There, they had picked up two new porters, called Sherpas, after the Eastern Nepali ethnic group, from Prasad's extended family. The day was clear, the sky a dazzling blue, with just a few fluffy clouds flirting with the peaks of the great mountains, as they headed out on foot into the hunting preserve. Anya couldn't help but notice that they hadn't checked in with the game park's administration in the small, picturesque village. She supposed it was obvious they weren't hunting game, even though Lal carried his inevitable Enfield, and a similar, battered old bolt-action rifle was slung over the shoulder of one of the Sherpas, whose names Anya had never quite caught. The air was crisp, the trees were evergreen, but some of the scrub was leafing out. The air had an astringent scent from the trees, as well as the weight and chill edge of the perpetual snows off of the peaks. Their destination, Anya's guides, had not yet disclosed.
I have heard of this Agrabat.
They hiked between gnarly-trunked rhododendrons with sprays of evergreen leaves like spearheads. They had not yet begun to flower.
He does not come from a bad family, but they fell on hard times.
Hard times fall on us all, Uncle. We don't all become bandits.
No, indeed. Yet when you are as old as I, you might find yourself not so quick to judge others. It is easier to feel compassion when one's blood has cooled from the fires of youth.
You killed him.
That is different. That was a matter of defending myself and our employer. But it does not mean I would presume to judge him.
Anya's mind wandered. She couldn't help worrying about the note's reference to her passing a test. She'd killed two men and played a pretty direct role in getting another killed. She thought of Buddhism as an intrinsically peaceful religion. She wrenched her attention back to the present. The cool, fresh air smelled of chilled, distant stone. The sun was warm on her face. The smooth, pebbled bottom of the brook continued to wind alongside their path.
The way he talked, Agrabat, I mean, were they really Maoists?
Not likely. Bandits have long been a problem here. Even during the war, we spent as much time hunting them as we did fighting the communist guerrillas.
There's a distinction?
The guerrillas tend to be better organized, although it is not always easy to tell. Sometimes the bandits pretend to be communists, and the communists are seldom reluctant to plunder. Expropriation, they call it. But Agrabat and his lot were clearly just vicious fools.
Anya was edging around a subject that had bothered her since the encounter with Agrabat, reluctant to confront it internally or externally. But now it seemed she couldn't avoid it any longer.
How do you think they found out about us? If Agrabat was such a low-level bandit, how did he know what we were doing?
The only logical conclusion seemed to be that someone had told him. That knowledge made Anya wonder if she could trust Prasad and Lal. Yet she had no choice but to rely on their expertise. She couldn't finish her mission without them.
Do you think we can take a single step without the people of the country knowing? This land seems unsettled to people who do not know it. But our folk live everywhere and see everywhere.
But what made Agrabat think we might be hunting treasure?
In these hard days, the people assume all expeditions hunt ancient treasure.
It's a poor country, Miss Creed. Now maybe more than ever, with the war starting up again and the global economy coming apart.
Well, then what about the real Maoists? What do they think we're up to? I mean, Commissioner Chatura is one of them, isn't he?
He is a party man, never a warrior. An organizer he was, administrator.
Schemer.
Are the Maoist guerrillas active in the area again?
Again? Still? They never went away, much less laid down their guns. As yet, there's no open fighting in the district. Who knows how long that will last?
You think they might be interested in us?
Not think, Missy. Not think. No. Major Jagannatha is an old leopard and a wily one.
Major Jagannatha?
He's another former Gurkha. Many of the guerrillas are, too.
Anya nodded. The Jagannatha was an immense cart used to haul an outsized idol of a Hindu god on religious festival days. The British colonizers had believed, or claimed to, that people flung themselves under the big wheels to allow themselves to be crushed as sacrifices. Modern Indians dismissed that angrily as racist propaganda, although Anya suspected that, given the nature of crowds and how crowded Indian cities had been throughout known history, people getting inadvertently run over was anything but rare.
He sounds like a dangerous man. Let's hope we don't meet him.
We will pray.
At the least, it can't hurt.
They hiked steep hills and narrow valleys, thickly forested. Climbing higher, they had left the rhododendron forests behind and come into a region of dark, shaggy hemlocks. Anya had noticed that, while Lal deferred to his elder relative when explanations were called for, and Prasad duly supplied them, most times Prasad said little while Lal chatted. It made Anya's lower back ache just to look at the packs they carried. But to them, clearly, this was literally just a walk in the park. Her respect for their sturdiness of body and spirit increased. She found these woods spooky. They were more like the ancient German forests that had so unnerved the Romans than anything Anya ever associated with Nepal. The photos and videos she'd seen of the country were all snowy peaks and Sherpas, not dense, dark woods. Not that the White Mountain wasn't making its presence felt. Even when she couldn't see it, Anya felt it threatening to topple on her. Daylight in the mountains was fleeting at best. In these claustrophobic valleys, the sun dropped from sight and the shadows began to thicken into twilight not terribly long after midday.
Where are we going?
She didn't really want to be caught out in the woods at night. She wasn't afraid of wild animals or even bad men, although knowing Major Jagannatha might be taking an interest in her could get to be a concern pretty quickly. Mainly, she was sure it wouldn't be very comfortable in a forest that daylight barely brushed at this time of year, particularly once the wind began to whistle through the valleys, down from the eternal ice fields of the greatest mountain range on Earth.
We go where we are summoned.
That was all she was going to get. Although she didn't entirely like the answer, she accepted it. In truth, he was doing what he was paid to do. He was guiding her. Particle by particle, the shadows condensed around them into dusk. Though the sky overhead remained a brilliant blue, the few cirrus clouds only beginning to blush with the pink of sunset, down here among the hemlock boughs, it was getting to be dark. The hiking party came around the side of a steep ridge, and Anya glimpsed a warm, orange glow ahead.
Is that where we're headed?
Yes.
The porters seemed nervous, although they continued to forge on stolidly beneath packs that looked as big as they were. Not briskly, but relentlessly, as if they could keep this pace up all night and all day tomorrow, and for all Anya knew, all week. As for herself, her own lean-muscled legs were beginning to ache. Her feet were sore, and she felt a little flutter in her quadriceps from the constant climbing along scanty trails. The glow vanished beyond a twist of the trail. Prasad and Lal picked up the pace. The rising sense of mystery actually invigorated Anya, and the change of pace itself provided a welcome break from the steady upward trudge of the past couple of hours. The trail wound around another bend, and they saw before them a tall wooden structure with a steeply pitched roof of wooden stakes and sweeping eaves. Torches burned to either side of the entrance, casting a wavering glow across a door painted red with gilded dragon figures twining up it. Anya's first thought was that it was an inn or maybe a hunting lodge.
The Lamasery of the Woods. Go on, Anya Crete. You are expected.
What about you?
We will be provided for. You must go inside.
Alone?
One always walks the path alone.
Trying to look bolder than she felt, Anya approached the door. Nothing happened. Anya turned back to look at her companions. The porters had shed their packs and squatted beside them, featureless shadows against gloom. Lal showed pale teeth in a smile Anya thought was supposed to be encouraging. Prasad simply stood, unmoving as a stone, gazing at her. The round lenses of his glasses were unreadable disks of reflected flame. She turned back to the door. She gazed at the two dragons carved on it, sinuous bodies intertwined like a DNA double helix. They seemed to writhe in the torchlight. She put a tentative hand to the heavy black iron latch.
Hello?
Knowing firsthand how actively Buddhist monks could express their resentment at unwanted intrusions, she stuck her head reluctantly inside. All she could see was a narrow corridor. Little copper dishes of oil, or yak butter, held burning wicks. They glowed yellow, but without actually casting much light. It was only the slight gleams from massive roof beams and polished floorboards that gave Anya any hint of the dimensions and solidity of the corridor. The little lamps flickered alarmingly in the breeze she was letting in. She was going to have to make up her mind quickly. If she let the wicks blow out, she did not want to try groping her way into the monastery in suffocating darkness. She stepped into the lamasery. Somewhere in her pack, she carried a small flashlight. She didn't fumble for it now. She felt nervous, uninvited. She did not want to literally highlight her invasion of this holy sanctum by blasting bright artificial light into it. Cautiously, she advanced. She then wondered if it could be a trap. But if Prasad or Lal wanted her dead, or secretly worked for someone who wanted her dead, they'd already had plenty of opportunities to make her disappear in the time she'd spent combing central Nepal with them.
No.
Whatever this was, it wasn't a trap meant to kill her. At least not at first. That raised the hairs at the nape of her neck. She knew there really were worse things than death. She'd encountered way too many of them in the past few years. The place sounded deserted, possibly for centuries. But someone had put those torches outside the door and lit them. Not too long ago, either. The same went for the lamps.
Hello. My name is Anya Creed. I don't want to go anywhere I'm not supposed to be.
Anya almost formed her right hand to summon the sword. Then she saw a hint of motion. It was deliberate enough not to feel threatening. She walked forward. When she was about halfway down the corridor, as far as she could tell, she made out a vertical slit of gray in the darkness in front of her. It suggested a door had opened a crack. She ran her fingers along the dark painted wall to her right. She detected expressed crossbeams and posts. She got the impression there might be doors in one or both walls. She couldn't tell for sure. The door ahead seemed to beckon her. She shrugged and walked forward. At the door, she paused.
Hello? Hello? Anybody here?
The dim gold gleam of a pair of bowl lamps illuminated another doorway. The dark wood door was open. Anya went to it. Inside was a chamber about 12 feet square. A circle of the bronze or copper bowls had been set out in the middle of it, with a diameter of perhaps 9 feet. At its center waited remarkable objects. She glimpsed other items laid against the far wall, indistinct in the gloom outside the circle of tiny yellow flames. The objects within the circle held her attention. To the right lay what appeared to be a large book, its pages warped and cover blackened and cracked with age and handling. On the left, a pile of golden coins glittered. At the edge of the circle, she paused. She wasn't sure why. She knew circles often served as ritual barriers, but she didn't believe in any of that. Nevertheless, she hesitated. Leaving the matter hanging for the moment, she sidled around the circle to the far wall. A rolled pallet lay there. Shrugging, she squirmed out of her pack straps. It was awfully heavy, and her shoulders were sore from bearing the weight. Getting free of the straps always made her feel better. She didn't care for confinement of any kind. Anya stepped into the circle and knelt facing the door. It had shut without a sound. She put it from her mind. It felt as if she were alone in the lamasery, but it had to be occupied, and the occupants were choosing to remain unseen. At least there were four walls and a roof. She wondered what kind of accommodations Prasad and the others would find to pass the night. She hoped they'd be comfortable. If anyone could find decent shelter, it had to be Prasad. Sitting back on her heels with hands on thighs, she studied the curious display before her by the yellow lamplight. Lying atop the small pile of golden, glittery discs was one showing the unmistakable head of Alexander the Great. Eyes wide, she reached for it. She stopped, with her fingers hovering just above it. For a moment, her hand looked like a pale spider, its underside turned scarcely less golden than the ancient Macedonian coins by the light of burning butter. Reluctantly, she withdrew her hand and studied the two displays.
Someone went to a lot of trouble to set up this whole tableau. It has to be a test. So I guess I'd better pass it.
Looking at it in that light, it seemed fairly obvious, simplistic even. Material desires versus longing for enlightenment.
Easy for you to say now, after your first response was to go grabbing like a magpie for the nice shiny gold thing.
She didn't know whether her invisible audience would understand her words. She took for granted she had one now. The llamas wanted to see how their test subject performed, after all. She didn't care what they might make of her words. Either she'd passed the test or was hopelessly adrift. She carefully lifted her pack over the lamps. Holding her digital camera, she looked around.
If you llamas don't want me doing this, feel free to speak right up. Or ask me before I leave to erase the images from the card. I'll do that if you want.
She moved around the pile of coins, aiming her camera. She took care not to upset any of the butter bowls. She also did her best to expose the ancient book to the flash as little as possible. It was unlikely the brief glare would damage it, but especially given what she intended next, she wanted to minimize the risk. When at last she'd taken sufficient shots of the coins, concentrating on the Alexander piece, she wrote everything down in her spiral-bound notebook. Then she turned her attention to the book. To avoid contaminating the binding or pages with finger oils, she pulled on thin latex gloves from her bag. She pulled over a couple of bowl lamps, being careful not to spill them, for light to work by. The book's cover was bound in thin, very fine-grained hide, blackened by age and probably finger grease. In fact, The grain was so fine, it made her shudder. Then again, she reminded herself that this wasn't the first old tome bound in human skin she'd handled. Cautiously, she opened the book. She was unsure what to expect. So she felt neither surprise nor disappointment to see she couldn't read any of it. Even if the writing had been transliterated into Latin characters, it was almost certainly a tongue she didn't know. She wished she could transcribe some of it, so that she could get it to a translator and find at least a clue as to what this was all about, and why it had been presented to her with such showmanship by the brothers of the Lamasery of the Woods. But she didn't dare use her flash for fear of degrading the brittle paper. Despite her lack of comprehension, the sinuous characters seemed to entice her eyes, draw them in and then along, as with the flow of a stream. She scanned the first page, then turned it, and worked her way down the next. A strange sense of peace suffused her, and her mind became a meditative blank. As she paged through the ancient volume, she lost track of time, of location, of the sound of the wind and the squeak of wooden joints. She lost all sense of self in the water-like rippling of unknowable words. It was as if the dancing letters conveyed some message directly to her subconscious without passing through her conscious mind. Anya found herself at the end. Closing the book, she sat back. She became aware of ferocious aches in her thighs and lower back.
Just how long did I spend at that?
Instead of checking the time on her cell phone, she stood and stretched. That helped, but her feet prickled as blood flowed back into them, and her joints still felt stiff. She returned the butter lamps to their original position in the circle. Then, working around lamps and relics, she performed some yoga poses. As well as gently unkinking her joints and muscles, the moves allowed her to slip into a familiar meditative space. She was aware, without forming thoughts, that this was different from the trance state in which she had read through the whole book without understanding a single character. It was as if she was somehow processing. For all her skepticism about the mystical, Anya had learned to respect the power of the human subconscious. In fact, she attributed much of what some people called extrasensory perception to the subconscious processing normal sensory inputs, of which the conscious mind was unaware. She perceived that something of that sort was happening, and she was content to let it. She realized she smelled smoke. Looking around quickly in alarm, she saw a brazier of glowing coals and several covered porcelain bowls had been placed just inside the door.
Is that really a good idea? This whole place is wood.
The bowl lamps didn't worry her much. The wood was dense and tough. She doubted a spill of cool-burning butter would make the floor take light. But a brazier full of hot coal was a real hazard.
The Lamas have run this place a long time, and they've got no electricity, much less natural gas. If they haven't burned the Lamasery down by now, what are the odds of them doing it tonight? Then again, how often do they host long-legged Western adventuresses who might inadvertently kick the brazier over in her sleep? Oh well, that's why they call it adventure.
She then discovered she was intensely hungry. She brought the bowls and then the brazier, holding on by a pair of wooden handles, over to the wall outside the circle of lamps. She opened the bowls to find steamed rice and beans, the standard daily Nepali fare. She ate, finding the food anything but bland as it might appear. It wasn't just hunger that added flavor to food she'd found, it was also strangeness. And this was high strangeness indeed. When she replaced the intricately painted lids on the bowls, they were all empty. Almost at once, she felt her eyelids sag. She found herself barely able to unroll the bedding and slip inside before her eyes closed.
Huh?
In the morning, she found the brazier glowing red with renewed coals. White sunlight slanted down from windows up beneath the rafters she hadn't known were there before. The coins, the book, and the butter lamps were gone. She smelled food. More legumes and rice awaited her in bowls, steaming hot. To the side was tea, flavored with rancid yak butter. She was ravenous again. As she ate, Anya tried to parse out exactly what had happened to her. As she finished the meal, she decided she had no idea. But the monks had staged a truly elaborate show on her behalf.
I guess I'll have to wait to find out.
To her surprise, she felt well-rested and not at all sore, given she'd passed the night on a hard plank floor with only a thin pad beneath her. She froze. A monk appeared. He wore yellow robes. His shaved head was painted with dots and lines in white. He smiled shyly, pressed palms together, and bowed to her. Recovering, she returned the greeting. He presented her with an envelope. It was a normal-appearing manila envelope, about 6 inches by 8, with the metal clasp fastened. She accepted it with a brow creased in puzzlement.
Thank you.
With clumsy fingers, she fumbled to open the clasp. She put her lack of dexterity down to the room's chill. Even though the brazier had been replenished during the night, it basically, so far as she could tell, prevented frost from forming on the walls, icicles dripping from the heavy rafters, and Anya from freezing into a woman-shaped plank, and not much more. Finally, she got the flap open and looked inside. It contained a scrap of paper, almost orange with age and dried to brittleness. She could clearly see that the writing on it, faded to a faint violet, was in Greek characters. She looked up. She was alone in the room. The door was closed. She felt an eerie sense the llama had never been real at all. But the paper was real enough. Feeling a stab of annoyance at the monks for such improper treatment of a clearly priceless document, she fumbled in a cargo pocket for a plastic bag. When she had the paper sealed safely away, she replaced it in the envelope. She hesitated. She wasn't about to entrust the frail scrap to a pocket, and much less fold it to fit. She wanted to keep it immobilized and protected. One classic field expedient method was to close it in the middle of a big book, preferably hardcover. But she was traveling much too lightly to carry anything that weighed that much and used up so much precious pack space. Kneeling, she placed the envelope carefully on the dark floorboards. Then she opened her pack and pulled out her computer. The manila envelope fit handily between the screen and the keyboard. The computer clasp wouldn't quite catch, but a couple of strips of the tape she carried as another frequently handy item secured the top well enough to satisfy her. Being stuffed in the pack would help hold the lid shut as well. After zipping the computer back into her backpack, she donned her heavy jacket, shouldered her pack, and stood. Clearly, it was time to go. In daytime, the lamasery corridors remained dim. The friendly glow of butter lamps burning in their niches showed her the way out. Brilliant morning sunshine made her blink. Chill air hit her in the face like a bucket of ice water. She barely noticed, because sitting on a rock, not 20 yards from her, with one long leg cocked over another and swinging idly, was Pantheras Katramatos. Anya ran to embrace Pan. His strong arms felt good around her. His long, wiry presence was a reassuring solidity in the warm sunlight after the unreality of the night before. Anya stepped back.
What the hell are you doing here?
I'm happy to see you too, Anya. I hope you're pleasantly surprised.
Behind him, Prasad, Lal, and the two Sherpas sat smoking. Their cousin Bahadur sat with them, his wounded arm in a sling.
Well, yes, but I'm still surprised.
Pan nodded. He wore a padded jacket in green and yellow over a pair of well-worn blue jeans and hiking boots. He was also wearing a holster beneath his left arm.
I suppose I owe you an explanation, Anya.
I don't know about owe, but it'd be nice if you gave me one anyway.
The Special Antiquities Task Force has decided to extend their investigation of the Bajraktari artifact smuggling ring to Nepal. For some reason, they chose me for the job.
Pan grinned as he spoke. For all his modest manner, he knew as well as she did how uniquely qualified he was for this mission. But his presence still seemed odd.
I didn't think they had the budget for this kind of junket.
Not on the basis of what we knew at the time you left. But we have received new intelligence. Enver Bajraktari, his henchman Duka, and a number of his gunmen have come to Nepal, specifically to hunt you down.
How did they know I was here?
Apparently their spies have penetrated the Greek military or law enforcement community more deeply than we feared. None of the task force's members has been corrupted, I think. Unfortunately, we are required to pass certain information on, both laterally and up the chain of command.
You think they might have got to some of your bosses?
Anything is possible, I'm afraid. But it could also be that no one in the Hellenic police deliberately shared this information with the gangsters. Somebody boasting in a taverna, a police bureaucrat trying to impress his mistress, and our government shares much information with other governments, especially where international terrorism might come into play. The leak may have originated elsewhere entirely.
So that's what brings you to Nepal. But how did you happen to wind up here, at this allegedly hidden lamasery in the middle of a Brothers Grimm forest?
On my own initiative, and telling no one else, I contacted the Japan Buddha Federation and explained to them that you were in great danger.
So now you've got an international reputation as a fighter of antiquities trafficking?
In a minor way, perhaps. The Buddhists satisfied themselves of my bona fides. They provided me contacts that led me to Baglong and this gentleman.
Bahadur.
Anya nodded and smiled at the Nepali. He grinned back.
Despite his help, I've searched for you for several days. It may sound paranoid, but I got the distinct feeling I was being tested somehow.
I have the same feeling, and I suspect we're both right. Take a look at this.
She handed him the scrap of paper.
I was rewarded with this after passing a test of my own. Inside were two displays, a book and Macedonian coins, Enlightenment versus Material Desires. I chose the book and passed.
Pan raised his eyebrows and nodded. Anya wondered what he'd experienced himself since arriving in the Mountain Kingdom. He turned his attention to the plastic bag in his hand. Instantly, his body language changed. He didn't quiver with excitement, but went taut with readiness.
It's in the Macedonian dialect of ancient Greek. It's a transcription.
I figured. I guess it's several hundred years old. Certainly not 2,300 years old, so it can't be original. You can read it, yes?
Oh, yes. The lamas must have copied it. Perhaps again and again. Most probably few of the transcribers could have read it, although no doubt they translated it somewhere along the line.
He raised his head to stare hard at the lamasery. Anya guessed Pan was holding a raging internal debate about pounding on the dragon door and demanding to be shown the rest of the manuscript the scrap came from. The archaeologist won out over the cop in him. This was what they were meant to have, so it had to satisfy them for now.
So what is it?
Anya angled herself to peer over his shoulder, trying to see through the dazzling highlights the bright mountain sun raised on the plastic bag. She still wouldn't be able to read the paper, even if she could see it.
This seems to be a journal written by my ancient namesake, General Pantaras himself.
You're kidding!
It's true. Or at least that's what it says. Listen to this. The yellow-robed monks seem to know of my quest, although it is to despoil them of the tribute to their own chief god or seer, they do not resist, but smile and nod and assure me that my feet are on the proper path to the greatest treasure of all. Their easy acquiescence gives me greater pause than the fiercest resistance, which, after all, I expected to encounter. Perhaps they intend to direct me deep into the jaws of a trap. If so, my duty to my king requires that I continue along my road.
And where does that go?
Pan raised his head and extended his arm to point to the angular white head of Dhaulagiri Peak, looming above the steep wooded hills that surrounded the lamasery and the valley.
Yeah.
Baglung District Commissioner Chatura set down his tea on his Spartan, scrupulously ordered desk and rose. He walked through the room divider and stepped into the waiting room. The two figures looming there crowded the room all by themselves. One was lean and wolfish. The other was so wide, especially in his heavily padded jacket, he resembled one of the legendary ape-human monsters, the so-called Banmanche, or Yeti, which the absurdly superstitious had recently begun reporting seeing again around Dalagiri.
Come on, then.
He turned briskly about and made himself strut back into his office. The men seemed to fill the district commissioner's tiny office to overflowing. To one side, a brass teapot bubbled on a hot plate atop a low bookcase stuffed with books of regulations and bound official documents.
Tea?
No, I don't want tea. It tastes like shit.
I am sure you know.
What was that?
Nothing.
The flamboyantly mustached Kosovar's bodyguard loomed behind him, thick arms folded over his chest.
Well, we bring you news from our places, comrade. Good news and bad.
Chatura simply stared.
Well, I shall tell you the bad news first, my friend. First, a meddling American woman named Anya Creed caused us to lose our last shipment to the Greek police. The good news is that the witch has come to Nepal.
How is it good news that this meddlesome Western woman has come here?
Chatura didn't see fit to mention he was well aware of the fact. He was too disappointed and angry at Bajraktari's first information. He had a substantial investment in that shipment.
Because she's on the trail of the greatest treasure trove in the Himalayas, the lost treasure of the highest shrine. All we have to do is follow her, and she'll lead us to unimaginable wealth. She's here, is she not?
Chatura conceded the fact with a slow nod. His scowl had, if anything, set harder.
She is. And I have already put Jagannatha on her trail.
Well, that's good, isn't it? You've told me of this man. He's a bulldog who will not lose the witch, nor give up the trail.
You don't understand. Although he is the regional commander of frontline revolutionary fighters, he is not objectively Marxist. He does not understand certain realities.
I thought the Major fought well in your revolution, not to mention successfully.
Chatura wondered if this ridiculous hairy barbarian dared to mock him for his less active role in the Civil War. It was men like himself, Chatura, who had done the real work of bringing the socialist revolution to this state, and small thanks he had received.
The Major is a hammer-headed fool. He is likely to persist until he kills this Creed woman or drives her away. And then we shall never claim the treasure for the proletarian revolution.
Bajraktari showed him a humorless grin full of teeth stained brown by strong tobacco and uncertain dental hygiene.
Then you'd best make sure he doesn't do any such foolish thing. You are his commissar. Surely he'll obey you.
I shall order him to back off and merely observe what the intruder does.
What about us?
You must return to the village and wait until I call you. I will send for you when I learn more. And now, I bid you good day.